objected to the facts. It is plain, then, what the equitable is, and that it is just and is better than one kind of justice. It is evident also from this who the equitable man is, the man who chooses and does such acts, and is no stickler for his rights in a bad sense, but tends to take less than his share, though he has the law oft his side, is equitable. And this state of character is equity, which is a sort of justice, and not a different state of character. 11. Whether a man can treat himself unjustly or not is evident from what has been said, for A. One class of just acts are those acts in accordance with any virtue which are prescribed by the law, e.g., the law does not expressly permit suicide, and what it does not expressly permit, it forbids. Again, when a man in violation of the law harms another, otherwise than in retaliation, voluntarily, he acts unjustly. And a voluntary agent is one who knows both the person he is affecting by his action and the instrument he is using. And he who through anger voluntarily stabs himself does this contrary to the right rule of life. And this the law does not allow. Therefore, he is acting unjustly, but towards whom? Surely towards the state, not towards himself. For he suffers voluntarily, but no one is voluntarily treated unjustly. This is also the reason why the state punishes. A certain loss of civil rights attaches to the man who destroys himself on the ground that he is treating the state unjustly. Further, B. In that sense of acting unjustly in which the man who acts unjustly is unjust only and not bad all round, it is not possible to treat oneself unjustly. This is different from the former sense. The unjust man, in one sense of the term, is wicked in a particularized way, just as the coward is, not in the sense of being wicked all round, so that his unjust act does not manifest wickedness in general. For, first, that would imply the possibility of the same things having been subtracted from and added to the same thing at the same time. But this is impossible. The just and the unjust always involve more than one person. Further, second, unjust action is voluntary and done by choice, and takes the initiative. For the man who, because he has suffered, does the same in return, is not thought to act unjustly. But if a man harms himself, he suffers and does the same things at the same time. Further, third, if a man could treat himself unjustly, he could be voluntarily treated unjustly. Besides, fourth, no one acts unjustly without committing particular acts of injustice, but no one can commit adultery with his own wife, or housebreaking on his own house, or theft on his own property. In general, the question, can a man treat himself unjustly, is solved also by the distinction we applied to the question, can a man be voluntarily treated unjustly? It is evident, too, that both are bad, being unjustly treated and acting unjustly. For the one means having less and the other having more than the intermediate amount, which plays the part here that the healthy does in the medical art, and that good condition does in the art of bodily training. But still acting unjustly is the worse, for it involves vice, and is blameworthy, involves vice, which is either of the complete and unqualified kind or almost so. We must admit the latter alternative, because not all voluntary unjust action implies injustice as a state of character, while being unjustly treated does not involve vice and injustice in oneself. In itself, then, being unjustly treated is less bad, but there is nothing to prevent its being incidentally a greater evil. But theory cares nothing for this, It calls pleurisy a more serious mischief than a stumble. Yet the latter may become incidentally the more serious, if the fall due to it leads to your being taken prisoner or put to death the enemy. Metaphorically, and in virtue of a certain resemblance, there is a justice, not indeed between a man and himself, but between certain parts of him. Yet not every kind of justice, but that of master and servant, or that of husband and wife. For these are the ratios in which the part of the soul that has a rational principle stands to the irrational part, and it is with a view to these parts that people also think a man can be unjust to himself, viz., because these parts are liable to suffer something contrary to their respective desires. There is therefore thought to be a mutual justice between them, as between ruler and ruled. Let this be taken as our account of justice and the other, i.e., the other moral virtues. Book 6. 1. Since we have previously said that one ought to choose that which is intermediate, not the excess nor the defect, and that the intermediate is determined by the dictates of the right rule, let us discuss the nature of these dictates. In all the states of character we have mentioned, as in all other matters, there is a mark to which the man who has the rule looks, and heightens or relaxes his activity accordingly, and there is a standard which determines the mean states, which we say are intermediate between excess and defect, being in accordance with the right rule. But such a statement, though true, is by no means clear. For not only here, but in all other pursuits, which are objects of knowledge, it is indeed true to say that we must not exert ourselves nor relax our efforts too much nor too little, but to an intermediate extent, and as the right rule dictates. But if a man had only this knowledge, he would be none the wiser, e.g., we should not know what sort of medicines to apply to our body if someone were to say, all those which the medical art prescribes and which agree with the practice of one who possesses the art. Hence, it is necessary with regard to the states of the soul also not only that this true statement should be made, but also that it should be determined what is the right rule and what is the standard that fixes it. We divided the virtues of the soul and said that some are virtues of character and others of intellect. Now we have discussed in detail the moral virtues. With regard to the others, let us express our view as follows, beginning with some remarks about the soul. We said before that there are two parts of the soul, that which grasps a rule or rational principle, and the irrational. Let us now draw a similar distinction within the part which grasps a rational principle, and let it be assumed that there are two parts which grasp a rational principle. One, by which we contemplate the kind of things whose originative causes are invariable, and one, by which we contemplate variable things. For where objects differ in kind, the part of the soul answering to each of the two is different in kind, since it is in virtue of a certain likeness and kinship with their objects that they have the knowledge they have. Let one of these parts be called the scientific, and the other the calculative. For to deliberate and to calculate are the same thing, but no one deliberates about the invariable. Therefore the calculative is one part of the faculty which grasps a rational principle. We must, then, learn what is the best state of each of these two parts, for this is the virtue of each. 2. The virtue of a thing is relative to its proper work. Now there are three things in the soul which control action and truth: sensation, reason, desire. Of these, sensation originates no action. This is plain from the fact that the lower animals have sensation, but no share in action. What affirmation and negation are in thinking, pursuit and avoidance are in desire. So that since moral virtue is a state of character concerned with choice, and choice is deliberate desire, therefore both the reasoning must be true and the desire right. If the choice is to be good, and the latter must pursue just what the former asserts, now this kind of intellect and of truth is practical. Of the intellect, which is contemplative, not practical, not productive, the good and the bad state are truth and falsity respectively. For this is the work of everything intellectual. While of the part which is practical and intellectual, the good state is truth in agreement with right desire. The origin of action, its efficient, not its final cause, is choice, and that of choice is desire and reasoning with a view to an end. This is why choice cannot exist, either without reason and intellect, or without a moral state. For good action and its opposite cannot exist without a combination of intellect and character. Intellect itself, however, moves nothing, but only the intellect which aims at an end and is practical. For this rules the productive intellect. As well, since everyone who makes, makes for an end. And that which is made is not an end in the unqualified sense, but only an end in a particular relation, and the end of a particular operation. Only that which is done is that, for good action is an end, and desire aims at this. Hence choice is either desiderative reason or ratiocinative desire. And such an origin of action is a man. It is to be noted that nothing that is past is an object of choice, e.g., no one chooses to have sacked Troy, for no one deliberates about the past, but about what is future and capable of being otherwise, while what is past is not capable of not having taken place. Hence, Agathon is right in saying, "For this alone is lacking even to God, to make undone things that have once been done." The work of both the intellectual parts, then, is truth. Therefore the states that are most strictly those in respect of which each of these parts will reach truth are the virtues of the two parts. 3. Let us begin, then, from the beginning, and discuss these states once more. Let it be assumed that the states by virtue of which the soul possesses truth by way of affirmation or denial are 5 in number, i.e., art, scientific knowledge, practical wisdom, philosophic wisdom, intuitive reason. We do not include judgment and opinion, because in these we may be mistaken. Now what scientific knowledge is, if we are to speak exactly and not follow mere similarities, is plain from what follows. We all suppose that what we know is not even capable of being otherwise. Of things capable of being otherwise we do not know, when they have passed outside our observation, whether they exist or not. Therefore the object of scientific knowledge is of necessity. Therefore it is eternal. For things that are of necessity in the unqualified sense are all eternal, and things that are eternal are ungenerated and imperishable. Again, every science is thought to be capable of being taught, and its object of being learned, and all teaching starts from what is already known, as we maintain in the Analytics also, for it proceeds sometimes through induction and sometimes by syllogism. Now induction is the starting point which knowledge even of the universal presupposes, while syllogism proceeds from universals. There are therefore starting points from which syllogism proceeds, which are not reached by syllogism. It is therefore by induction that they are acquired. Scientific knowledge is then a state of capacity to demonstrate, and has the other limiting characteristics which we specify in the Analytics, for it is when a man believes in a certain way, and the starting points are known to him, that he has scientific knowledge, since if they are not better known to him than the conclusion, he will have his knowledge only incidentally. Let this, then, be taken as our account of scientific knowledge. 4. In the variable are included both things made and things done. Making and acting are different. For their nature, we treat even the discussions outside our school as reliable. So that the reasoned state of capacity to act is different from the reasoned state of capacity to make. Hence, too, they are not included one in the other. For neither is acting making, nor is making acting. Now, since architecture is an art, and is essentially a reasoned state of capacity to make, and there is neither any art that is not such a state, nor any such state that is not an art. Art is identical with the state of capacity to make, involving a true course of reasoning. All art is concerned with coming into being, i.e. with contriving and considering how something may come into being which is capable of either being or not being, and whose origin is in the maker and not in the thing made. For art is concerned neither with things that are, or come into being, by necessity, nor with things that do so in accordance with nature, since these have their origin in themselves. Making and acting being different, art must be a matter of making, not of acting. And in a sense, chance and art are concerned with the same objects. As Agathon says, art loves chance, and chance loves art. Art, then, as has been, is a state concerned with making, involving a true course of reasoning, and lack of art, on the contrary, is a state concerned with making, involving a false course of reasoning. Both are concerned with the variable. 5. Regarding practical wisdom, we shall get at the truth by considering who are the persons we credit with it. Now it is thought to be the mark of a man of practical wisdom to be able to deliberate well about what is good and expedient for himself, not in some particular respect, e.g. about what sorts of thing conduce to health or to strength, but about what sorts of thing conduce to the good life in general. This is shown by the fact that we credit men with practical wisdom in some particular respect when they have calculated well with a view to some good end, which is one of those that are not the object of any art. It follows that in the general sense, also the man who is capable of deliberating has practical wisdom. Now, no one deliberates about things that are invariable, nor about things that it is impossible for him to do. Therefore, since scientific knowledge involves demonstration, but there is no demonstration of things whose first principles are variable, for all such things might actually be otherwise, and since it is impossible to deliberate about things that are of necessity, practical wisdom cannot be scientific knowledge nor art, not science, because that which can be done is capable of being otherwise, not art, because action and making are different kinds of thing. The remaining alternative, then, is that it is a true and reasoned state of capacity to act with regard to the things that are good or bad for man. For while making has an end other than itself, action cannot. For good action itself is its end. It is for this reason that we think Pericles and men like him have practical wisdom, viz., because they can see what is good for themselves and what is good for men in general. We consider that those can do this who are good at managing households or states. This is why we call temperance, sophrosyne, by this name. We imply that it preserves one's practical wisdom. Sosusa tan phronsin. Now, what it preserves is a judgment of the kind we have described. For it is not any and every judgment that pleasant and painful objects destroy and pervert, e.g. the judgment that the triangle has or has not its angles equal to two right angles, but only judgments about what is to be done. For the originating causes of the things that are done consist in the end at which they are aimed. But the man who has been ruined by pleasure or pain forthwith fails to see any such originating cause. To see that for the sake of this, or because of this he ought to choose and do whatever he chooses and does, for vice is destructive of the originating cause of action. Practical wisdom, then, must be a reasoned and true state of capacity to act with regard to human goods. But further, while there is such a thing as excellence in art, there is no such thing as excellence in practical wisdom. And in art, he who errs willingly is preferable, but in practical wisdom, as in the virtues, he is the reverse. Plainly, then, practical wisdom is a virtue, and not an art. There being two parts of the soul that can follow a course of reasoning, it must be the virtue of one of the two, i.e., of that part which forms opinions. For opinion is about the variable, and so is practical wisdom. But yet, it is not only a reasoned state. This is shown by the fact that a state of that sort may be forgotten, but practical wisdom cannot. 6. Scientific knowledge is judgment about things that are universal and necessary, and the conclusions of demonstration, and all scientific knowledge, follow from first principles. For scientific knowledge involves apprehension of a rational ground. This being so, the first principle from which what is scientifically known follows cannot be an object of scientific knowledge, of art, or of practical wisdom, for that which can be scientifically known can be demonstrated, and art and practical wisdom deal with things that are variable. Nor are these first principles the object of philosophic wisdom, for it is a mark of the philosopher to have demonstration about some things. If, then, the states of mind by which we have truth and are never deceived about things invariable, or even variable, are scientific knowledge, practical wisdom, philosophic wisdom, and intuitive reason, and it cannot be any of the three, i.e. practical wisdom, scientific knowledge, or philosophic wisdom, the remaining alternative is that it is intuitive reason that grasps the first principles. 7. Wisdom. First, in the arts we ascribe to their most finished exponents, e.g. to Phidias as a sculptor and to Polycletus as a maker of portrait statues. And here we mean nothing by wisdom except excellence in art. But second, we think that some people are wise in general, not in some particular field, or in any other limited respect. As Homer says in the Margites, "Him did the gods make neither a digger, nor yet a ploughman, nor wise in anything else." Therefore wisdom must plainly be the most finished of the forms of knowledge. It follows that the wise man must not only know what follows from the first principles, but must also possess truth about the first principles. Therefore wisdom must be intuitive reason combined with scientific knowledge of the highest objects which has received, as it were, its proper completion. Of the highest objects, we say, for it would be strange to think that the art of politics or practical wisdom is the best knowledge, since man is not the best thing in the world. Now if what is healthy or good is different for men and for fishes, but what is white or straight is always the same, anyone would say that what is wise is the same, but what is practically wise is different. For it is to that which observes well the various matters concerning itself that one ascribes practical wisdom, and it is to this that one will entrust such matters. This is why we say that some, even of the lower animals, have practical wisdom, viz., those which are found to have a power of foresight with regard to their own life. It is evident also that philosophic wisdom and the art of politics cannot be the same, for if the state of mind concerned with a man's own interests is to be called philosophic wisdom, there will be many philosophic wisdoms. There will not be one concerned with the good of all animals, any more than there is one art of medicine for all existing things, but a different philosophic wisdom about the good of each species. But if the argument be that man is the best of the animals, this makes no difference. For there are other things much more divine in their nature even than man, e.g., most conspicuously, the bodies of which the heavens are framed. From what has been said, it is plain, then, that philosophic wisdom is scientific knowledge combined with intuitive reason of the things that are highest by nature. This is why we say Anaxagoras, Thales, and men like them have philosophic but not practical wisdom, when we see them ignorant of what is to their own advantage, and why we say that they know things that are remarkable, admirable, difficult, and divine, but useless, viz., because it is not human goods that they seek. Practical wisdom, on the other hand, is concerned with things human and things about which it is possible to deliberate. For we say this is above all the work of the man of practical wisdom, to deliberate well. But no one deliberates about things invariable, nor about things which have not an end, and that a good that can be brought about by action. The man who is without qualification, good at deliberating, is the man who is capable of aiming in accordance with calculation at the best, for man, of things attainable by action. Nor is practical wisdom concerned with universals only. It must also recognize the particulars, for it is practical, and practice is concerned with particulars. This is why some who do not know, and especially those who have experience, are more practical than others who know, for if a man knew that light meats are digestible and wholesome, but did not know which sorts of meat are light, he would not produce health, but the man who knows that chicken is wholesome is more likely to produce health. Now practical wisdom is concerned with action, therefore one should have both forms of it, or the latter in preference to the former. But of practical as of philosophic wisdom, there must be a controlling kind. 8. Political wisdom and practical wisdom are the same state of mind, but their essence is not the same. Of the wisdom concerned with the city, the practical wisdom which plays a controlling part is legislative wisdom, while that which is related to this as particulars to their universal is known by the general name political wisdom. This has to do with action and deliberation, for a decree is a thing to be carried out in the form of an individual act. This is why the exponents of this art are alone said to take part in politics, for these alone do things as manual laborers do things. Practical wisdom also is identified especially with that form of it which is concerned with a man himself, with the individual, and this is known by the general name practical wisdom. Of the other kinds, one is called household management, another legislation, the third politics. And of the latter, one part is called deliberative, and the other judicial. Now, knowing what is good for oneself will be one kind of knowledge, but it is very different from the other kinds, and the man who knows and concerns himself with his own interests is thought to have practical wisdom, while politicians are thought to be busybodies. Hence the word of Euripides, "But how could I be wise, who might at ease, numbered among the army's multitude, have had an equal share?" for those who aim too high and do too much. Those who think thus seek their own good and consider that one ought to do so. From this opinion, then, has come the view that such men have practical wisdom, yet perhaps one's own good cannot exist without household management, nor without a form of government. Further, how one should order one's own affairs is not clear, and needs inquiry. What has been said is confirmed by the fact that while young men become geometricians and mathematicians and wise in matters like these, it is thought that a young man of practical wisdom cannot be found. The cause is that such wisdom is concerned not only with universals but with particulars, which become familiar from experience. But a young man has no experience, for it is length of time that gives experience. Indeed, one might ask this question too, why a boy may become a mathematician but not a philosopher or a physicist. It is because the objects of mathematics exist by abstraction, while the first principles of these other subjects come from experience. And because young men have no conviction about the latter but merely use the proper language, while the essence of mathematical objects is plain enough to them. Further, error in deliberation may be either about the universal or about the particular. We may fail to know either that all water that weighs heavy is bad, or that this particular water weighs heavy. That practical wisdom is not scientific knowledge is evident, for it is, as has been said, concerned with the ultimate particular fact, since the thing to be done is of this nature. It is opposed, then, to intuitive reason, for intuitive reason is of the limiting premises, for which no reason can be given, while practical wisdom is concerned with the ultimate particular, which is the object not of scientific knowledge but of perception, not the perception of qualities peculiar to one sense, but a perception akin to that by which we perceive that the particular figure before us is a triangle. For in that direction, as well as in that of the major premise, there will be a limit. But this is rather perception than practical wisdom, though it is another kind of perception than that of the qualities peculiar to each sense. 9. There is a difference between inquiry and deliberation. For deliberation is inquiry into a particular kind of thing. We must grasp the nature of excellence in deliberation, as well whether it is a form of scientific knowledge, or opinion, or skill in conjecture, or some other kind of thing. Scientific knowledge it is not, but good deliberation is a kind of deliberation, and he who deliberates inquires and calculates. Nor is it skill in conjecture, for this both involves no reasoning and is something that is quick in its operation, while men deliberate a long time, and they say that one should carry out quickly the conclusions of one's deliberation, but should deliberate slowly. Again, readiness of mind is different from excellence in deliberation. It is a sort of skill in conjecture. Nor again is excellence in deliberation opinion of any sort. But since the man who deliberates badly makes a mistake, while he who deliberates well does so correctly, excellence in deliberation is clearly a kind of correctness, but neither of knowledge nor of opinion. For there is no such thing as correctness of knowledge, since there is no such thing as error of knowledge. And correctness of opinion is truth, and at the same time everything that is an object of opinion is already determined. But again, excellence in deliberation involves reasoning. The remaining alternative, then, is that it is correctness of thinking, for this is not yet assertion, since, while even opinion is not inquiry, but has reached the stage of assertion, the man who is deliberating whether he does so well or ill is searching for something and calculating. But excellence in deliberation is a certain correctness of deliberation. Hence we must first inquire what deliberation is and what it is about. And, there being more than one kind of correctness, plainly excellence in deliberation is not any and every kind, for, first, the incontinent man, and the bad man if he is clever, will reach as a result of his calculation what he sets before himself, so that he will have deliberated correctly. But he will have got for himself a great evil. Now to have deliberated well is thought to be a good thing, for it is this kind of correctness of deliberation that is excellence in deliberation, viz., that which tends to attain what is good, but, second, it is possible to attain even good by a false syllogism, and to attain what one ought to do, but not by the right means, the middle term being false. So that this, too, is not yet excellence in deliberation, this state in virtue of which one attains what one ought, but not by the right means. Again, third, it is possible to attain it by long deliberation, while another man attains it quickly. Therefore, in the former case, we have not yet got excellence in deliberation, which is rightness with regard to the expedient rightness in respect both of the end, the manner, and the time. Fourthly, further, it is possible to have deliberated well either in the unqualified sense or with reference to a particular end. Excellence in deliberation in the unqualified sense, then, is that which succeeds with reference to what is the end in the unqualified sense, and excellence in deliberation in a particular sense is that which succeeds relatively to a particular end. If, then, it is characteristic of men of practical wisdom to have deliberated well, excellence in deliberation will be correctness with regard to what conduces to the end of which practical wisdom is the true apprehension. 10. Understanding also, and goodness of understanding, in virtue of which men are said to be men of understanding or of good understanding, are neither entirely the same as opinion or scientific knowledge, for at that rate all men would have been men of understanding. Nor are they one of the particular sciences, such as medicine, the science of things connected with health, or geometry, the science of spatial magnitudes. For understanding is neither about things that are always and are unchangeable, nor about any and every one of the things that come into being, but about things which may become subjects of questioning and deliberation. Hence, it is about the same objects as practical wisdom. But understanding and practical wisdom are not the same. For practical wisdom issues commands, since its end is what ought to be done or not to be done, but understanding only judges. Understanding is identical with goodness of understanding, men of understanding with men of good understanding. Now, understanding is neither the having nor the acquiring of practical wisdom, but as learning is called understanding when it means the exercise of the faculty of knowledge, so understanding is applicable to the exercise of the faculty of opinion for the purpose of judging of what someone else says about matters with which practical wisdom is concerned, and of judging soundly. For well and soundly are the same thing. And from this has come the use of the name understanding, in virtue of which men are said to be of good understanding, viz., from the application of the word to the grasping of scientific truth. For we often call such grasping understanding. 11. What is called judgment, in virtue of which men are said to be sympathetic judges and to have judgment, is the right discrimination of the equitable. This is shown by the fact that we say the equitable man is above all others a man of sympathetic judgment, and identify equity with sympathetic judgment about certain facts. And sympathetic judgment is judgment which discriminates what is equitable and does so correctly. And correct judgment is that which judges what is true. Now all the states we have considered converge, as might be expected, to the same point. For when we speak of judgment and understanding and practical wisdom and intuitive reason, we credit the same people with possessing judgment and having reached years of reason and with having practical wisdom and understanding. For all these faculties deal with ultimates, i.e., with particulars. And being a man of understanding and of good or sympathetic judgment consists in being able to judge about the things with which practical wisdom is concerned. For the equities are common to all good men in relation to other men. Now all things which have to be done are included among particulars or ultimates. For not only must the man of practical wisdom know particular facts, but understanding and judgment are also concerned with things to be done, and these are ultimates. And intuitive reason is concerned with the ultimates in both directions, for both the first terms and the last are objects of intuitive reason and not of argument. And the intuitive reason which is presupposed by demonstrations grasps the unchangeable and first terms, while the intuitive reason involved in practical reasonings grasps the last and variable fact, i.e., the minor premise. For these variable facts are the starting points for the apprehension of the end, since the universals are reached from the particulars. Of these, therefore, we must have perception, and this perception is intuitive reason. This is why these states are thought to be natural endowments. Why? While no one is thought to be a philosopher by nature, people are thought to have by nature judgment, understanding, and intuitive reason. This is shown by the fact that we think our powers correspond to our time of life, and that a particular age brings with it intuitive reason and judgment. This implies that nature is the cause, hence intuitive reason is both beginning and end, for demonstrations are from these and about these. Therefore, we ought to attend to the undemonstrated sayings and opinions of experienced and older people, or of people of practical wisdom not less than to demonstrations. For because experience has given them an eye, they see aright. We have stated, then, what practical and philosophic wisdom are, and with what each of them is concerned. And we have said that each is the virtue of a different part of the soul. 12. Difficulties might be raised as to the utility of these qualities of mind, for, first, philosophic wisdom will contemplate none of the things that will make a man happy, for it is not concerned with any coming into being. And though practical wisdom has this merit, for what purpose do we need it? Practical wisdom is the quality of mind concerned with things just and noble and good for man. But these are the things which it is the mark of a good man to do. And we are none the more able to act for knowing them if the virtues are states of character, just as we are none the better able to act for knowing the things that are healthy and sound, in the sense of not producing but of issuing from the state of health. For we are none the more able to act for having the art of medicine or of gymnastics. But, second, if we are to say that a man should have practical wisdom not for the sake of knowing moral truths, but for the sake of becoming good, practical wisdom will be of no use to those who are good. Again, It is of no use to those who have not virtue, for it will make no difference whether they have practical wisdom themselves or obey others who have it. And it would be enough for us to do what we do in the case of health. Though we wish to become healthy, yet we do not learn the art of medicine. Third, besides this, it would be thought strange if practical wisdom, being inferior to philosophic wisdom, is to be put in authority over it, as seems to be implied by the fact that the art which produces anything rules and issues commands about that thing. These, then, are the questions we must discuss. So far we have only stated the difficulties. Now first, let us say that in themselves these states must be worthy of choice because they are virtues of the two parts of the soul respectively, even if neither of them produce anything. Secondly, they do produce something, not as the art of medicine produces health, however, but as health produces health. So does philosophic wisdom produce happiness, for being a part of virtue entire, by being possessed and by actualizing itself, it makes a man happy. Third, again, the work of man is achieved only in accordance with practical wisdom as well as with moral virtue. For virtue makes us aim at the right mark, and practical wisdom makes us take the right means. Of the fourth part of the soul, the nutritive, there is no such virtue, for there is nothing which it is in its power to do or not to do. Fourth, with regard to our being none the more able to do because of our practical wisdom what is noble and just, let us begin a little further back, starting with the following principle. As we say that some people who do just acts are not necessarily just, i.e. those who do the acts ordained by the laws either unwillingly or owing to ignorance or for some other reason and not for the sake of the acts themselves, though to be sure, they do what they should and all the things that the good man ought. So is it seems, that in order to be good, one must be in a certain state when one does the several acts, i.e., one must do them as a result of choice and for the sake of the acts themselves. Now virtue makes the choice right, but the question of the things which should naturally be done to carry out our choice belongs not to virtue but to another faculty. We must devote our attention to these matters and give a clearer statement about them. There is a faculty which is called cleverness. And this is such as to be able to do the things that tend towards the mark we have set before ourselves, and to hit it. Now, if the mark be noble, the cleverness is laudable. But if the mark be bad, the cleverness is mere smartness. Hence we call even men of practical wisdom clever or smart. Practical wisdom is not the faculty, but it does not exist without this faculty. And this eye of the soul acquires its formed state not without the aid of virtue, as has been said and is plain, for the syllogisms which deal with acts to be done are things which involve a starting point, viz., since the end, i.e., what is best, is of such and such a nature, whatever it may be, let it for the sake of argument be what we please, and this is not evident except to the good man. For wickedness perverts us, and causes us to be deceived about the starting points of action. Therefore, it is evident that it is impossible to be practically wise without being good. 13. We must therefore consider virtue also once more. For virtue too is similarly related, as practical wisdom is to cleverness, not the same, but like it, so is natural virtue to virtue in the strict sense. For all men think that each type of character belongs to its possessors in some sense by nature, For from the very moment of birth we are just or fitted for self-control, or brave, or have the other moral qualities. But yet we seek something else as that which is good in the strict sense. We seek for the presence of such qualities in another way. For both children and brutes have the natural dispositions to these qualities, but without the reason these are evidently hurtful. Only we seem to see this much, that while one may be led astray by them, as a strong body which moves without sight may stumble badly because of its lack of sight, still, if a man once acquires reason, that makes a difference in action, and his state, while still like what it was, will then be virtue in the strict sense. Therefore, as in the part of us which forms opinions, there are two types, cleverness and practical wisdom, so too in the moral part there are two types, natural virtue and virtue in the strict sense. And of these, the latter involves practical wisdom. This is why some say that all the virtues are forms of practical wisdom, and why Socrates in one respect was on the right track while in another he went astray. In thinking that all the virtues were forms of practical wisdom, he was wrong, but in saying they implied practical wisdom, he was right. This is confirmed by the fact that even now all men, when they define virtue, after naming the state of character and its objects, add that state, which is in accordance with the right rule. Now the right rule is that which is in accordance with practical wisdom. All men then seem somehow to divine that this kind of state is virtue, viz., that which is in accordance with practical wisdom. But we must go a little further. For it is not merely the state in accordance with the right rule, but the state that implies the presence of the right rule, that is virtue. And practical wisdom is a right rule about such matters. Socrates, then, thought the virtues were rules or rational principles, for he thought they were, all of them, forms of scientific knowledge, while we think they involve a rational principle. It is clear, then, from what has been said, that it is not possible to be good in the strict sense without practical wisdom, nor practically wise without moral virtue. But in this way, we may also refute the dialectical argument whereby it might be contended that the virtues exist in separation from each other. The same man, it might be said, is not best equipped by nature for all the virtues, so that he will have already acquired one when he has not yet acquired another. This is possible in respect of the natural virtues, but not in respect of those in respect of which a man is called, without qualification, good. For with the presence of the one quality, practical wisdom, will be given all the virtues. And it is plain that, even if it were of no practical value, we should have needed it, because it is the virtue of the part of us in question. Plain, too, that the choice will not be right without practical wisdom any more than without virtue. For the one determines the end, and the other makes us do the things that lead to the end. But again, it is not supreme over philosophic wisdom, i.e., over the superior part of us, any more than the art of medicine is over health, for it does not use it but provides for its coming into being. It issues orders then for its sake, but not to it. Further, to maintain its supremacy would be like saying that the art of politics rules the gods because it issues orders about all the affairs of the state. Book 7. 1. Let us now make a fresh beginning and point out that of moral states to be avoided, there are three kinds: vice, incontinence, brutishness. The contraries of two of these are evident, one we call virtue, the other continence. To brutishness, it would be most fitting to oppose superhuman virtue, a heroic and divine kind of virtue, as Homer has represented Priam saying of Hector that he was very good. For he seemed not, he, the child of a mortal man, but as one that of God's seed came. Therefore if, as they say, men become gods by excess of virtue, of this kind must evidently be the state opposed to the brutish state. For as a brute has no vice or virtue, so neither has a god. His state is higher than virtue, and that of a brute is a different kind of state from vice. Now, since it is rarely that a godlike man is found, to use the epithet of the Spartans, who when they admire any one highly call him a godlike man, so too the brutish type is rarely found among men. It is found chiefly among barbarians, but some brutish qualities are also produced by disease or deformity. And we also call by this evil name those men who go beyond all ordinary standards by reason of vice. Of this kind of disposition, however, we must later make some mention. While we have discussed vice before, we must now discuss incontinence and softness, or effeminacy, and continence and endurance. For we must treat each of the two neither as identical with virtue or wickedness, nor as a different genus. We must, as in all other cases, set the observed facts before us, and after first discussing the difficulties, go on to prove, if possible, the truth of all the common opinions about these affections of the mind, or failing this, of the greater number and the most authoritative. For if we both refute the objections and leave the common opinions undisturbed, we shall have proved the case sufficiently. Now, first, both continence and endurance are thought to be included among things good and praiseworthy, and both incontinence and softness among things bad and blameworthy. And the same man is thought to be continent and ready to abide by the result of his calculations, or incontinent and ready to abandon them. And second, the incontinent man, knowing that what he does is bad, does it as a result of passion, while the continent man, knowing that his appetites are bad, refuses on account of his rational principle to follow them. Third, the temperate man all men call continent and disposed to endurance, while the continent man some maintain to be always temperate, but others do not, and some call the self-indulgent man incontinent and the incontinent man self-indulgent indiscriminately, while others distinguish them. Fourth, the man of practical wisdom, they sometimes say, cannot be incontinent, while sometimes they say that some who are practically wise and clever are incontinent. Again, fifth, men are said to be incontinent even with respect to anger, honour, and gain. These, then, are the things that are said. 2. Now we may ask, first, how a man who judges rightly can behave incontinently. That he should behave so when he has knowledge, some say, is impossible. For it would be strange, so Socrates thought, if when knowledge was in a man, something else could master it and drag it about like a slave. For Socrates was entirely opposed to the view in question, holding that there is no such thing as incontinence. No one, he said, when he judges, acts against what he judges best. People act so only by reason of ignorance. Now, this view plainly contradicts the observed facts, and we must inquire about what happens to such a man if he acts by reason of ignorance. What is the manner of his ignorance? For that the man who behaves incontinently does not, before he gets into this state, think he ought to act so, is evident. But there are some who concede certain of Socrates' contentions, but not others. That nothing is stronger than knowledge, they admit. but not that on which one acts contrary to what has seemed to him the better course, and therefore they say that the incontinent man has not knowledge when he is mastered by his pleasures, but opinion. But if it is opinion, and not knowledge, if it is not a strong conviction that resists, but a weak one, as in men who hesitate, we sympathize with their failure.